Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and this is the 4th of December 2013. And as you probably know, I've been doing a series on the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism. So I have good news and bad news. The good news is that tonight's talk will be great. All right. The bad news is that, as best I can tell, I failed to record somehow last week's talk. So part of what will make this talk great is I'm going to give you the highlights of last week's talk without the pain and suffering involved, because last week was all about pain and suffering. Okay, so if you'll bear with me, and I think I've got my technology going, and I'm going to double check it. Yes. Okay, good. So the short version is that, to kind of lay a foundation, the Four Noble Truths are, in many ways, the Buddha's, you know, one of his more fundamental teachings. It said, as he put it, I teach only one thing, suffering and its end. Interestingly, he put those two things as one thing, suffering and its end. That, for him, was the essence of his teaching. And so to do that, it's important to understand what is suffering, what causes it, whether it's possible to bring the cause of suffering to an end, and thus suffering itself, and what the path is that embodies and leads to that ending of the cause of suffering. Right? Thus the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the possibility of ending the cause of suffering, and the path leading to the ending of that cause. In a nutshell, okay, that was clear. Good, let's keep going. So last time and the time before, I talked about the nature of suffering and made a distinction between inescapable, unavoidable pain and optional suffering. And in the last week, I talked about the inherent nature of pain, the inevitability of pain for animals, particularly animals with a nervous system. And I summarized the disconnection between the three fundamental needs for any animal, including a microbe, a protozoan, even a plant, the three fundamental needs for any living organism to exist, and the conflict between that need and the nature of reality. So as a quick summary, I pointed out that for any organism to live, it needs to separate itself from the world. Second, it needs to stabilize dynamic processes within a healthy equilibrium range. And third, it needs to get away from that which is threatening. It needs to get a hold of the good stuff it needs to live. And it needs to, in some way, shape, or form, interact with other members of its species, whether it's to exchange pollen as a plant or mate as a little tiny millimeter-long worm that today still uses oxytocin molecules to guide its sexual behavior. The problem is that, as Alan Watts put it, life is wiggly. In other words, that trying to separate ourselves from a world that we're continually exchanging energy with and nutrients with and communications with is fundamentally impossible. Stabilizing dynamic systems within tight ranges, including systems of systems of systems of systems in the overall architecture of the body, like file folders within file folders within file folders in the architecture of a computer, is also fundamentally impossible because, as the Buddha pointed out, everything is continually changing. And also, it's impossible to, you know, steer clear of all harms when we're all faced with ultimately old age, disease, and death. It's impossible to hold on to all the good stuff because it's always transient and slipping through our fingers as fast as we experience it. And it's impossible to utterly preserve our connections with others because, as it's said in Tibet, is it actually given to you to avoid being separated one day, one way or another, from everything you love? To help animals survive, Mother Nature has endowed them with alarm systems so that the alarms go off when any one of these three fundamental needs are not fulfilled. Needs for separation, for stability, or in a broad overarching umbrella term, goodies, all right? These alarms go off outside of awareness in many ways, down in terms of biochemical sensing systems and all the rest of that. And a fraction of them bubble up into the nervous system and are experienced as pain. Both physical pain, the hand on a hot stove, or the pain of something we need as a reward, like air, or warmth taken away from us, or besides those kinds of inherent physical pains, social pains, because as the most social species, the most social animal on the planet, if someone we love is threatened or harmed, that will be pain. It's inevitable pain. Who would ever want to have a heart so equanimous so as to not feel pain at the thought of the death of a child, for example? That's the inevitability of pain. There's no way around it in this life. Now, interestingly, to make a technical but very important point, in the best we can gather of what the Buddha taught, he said that suffering, the umbrella term for suffering being dukkha in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, that suffering included both pain and avoidable upset, unavoidable pain and avoidable upset. How could you possibly, though, avoid pain in this life? And that's where I think the Buddhist frame of reference of multiple lives comes in. The ultimate way to become free of that aspect of suffering, of dukkha broadly defined, that is inevitable, unavoidable physical and emotional pain, is to gradually undo the causes of rebirth, so that ultimately those causes fall away, and as the causes of rebirth fall away, so does the effect, and thus no more rebirth. You don't have to buy that, right? Many people, Stephen Batchelor and others whom I respect highly, argue that you can have a perfectly powerful Buddhist practice without buying into this cosmology. But in my view, you can't make sense of the Buddhist claims about the possibility of the absolute end of all pain and suffering, right, without taking into account his view that there were multiple lives. That said, while pain, in the sense that I'm meaning it here, is unavoidable, inescapable physical and emotional pain, while pain may not be avoidable in this life, suffering certainly is. And so the question then becomes, what are the causes of suffering such that we can gradually undo those causes? Okay? And as a takeaway from a practical standpoint, to bring us up to present time from last week and the week before it in this series I'm trying to do around the evolutionary neuropsychology, the Four Noble Truths. Sounds really ambitious, doesn't it? But anyway, I like sitting down at the drain at the bottom of pools. But anyway, my point is that two takeaways. One is to be open to suffering, your own and other people. We tend to defend against suffering, our own and others. We ward it off. We're embarrassed about it. We turn away when we see it. Instead, using one of the ways of defining the noble truths as ennobling, open to the ennobling power of seeing suffering clearly and squarely, your own and others. And second, recognize the inevitability of pain in this life. In fact, arguably, a subtle sense of contraction or unease or disturbance that's present in every moment of awareness. Not as the entirety of awareness. It's not that life is only pain, but in that, in the total mosaic of life, moment to moment to moment, there will be pain. And I think you can also recognize, actually, that even in a wonderful moment, in some subtle way, there is some sense of contraction or unease or unsatisfactoriness that's unavoidable, that I think has to do with fundamentally the nature of cognition as continually needing to stabilize extremely dynamic neural processes to function, and yet even as there's an attempt to stabilize them, to distinguish, for example, between a banana and a tree, friend and foe, those neural coalitions of synapses are decaying even as there's an attempt to stabilize them. So there's a kind of inherent tension in living as an animal with a nervous system. see for yourself if you can recognize, or if it's real for you, that subtle, inevitable tile in the mosaic of experience that will always feel a little uncomfortable. So the second practical takeaway, besides the first one of opening to suffering in oneself and others, I would offer to you not fighting pain. Not being unrealistic about its inevitability. Not being grandiose that one can absolutely defeat pain. And not overreacting to pain. So I think that was the second offering from last week. Okay, now we're kind of current, all right? So, all right, so far so good. So then the question becomes, how do we think about the causes of suffering, right? Now we're up to the second noble truth. And 2 points here. So first of all, it's interesting that the Buddha's framing is very much around processes and causes. Suffering is seen as a process. And the Buddha is taking us into what are the causes of this dynamic thing. So we're thinking about causes, right? We're attending to causes. And we're trying to influence causes over time. Second, isn't it interesting that when he talks about the fundamental cause of suffering, for him, that cause is in the territory of motivation or wanting, rather than that cause being a viewpoint, or that cause being the presumption of an I, or that cause being a particular emotion. From a psychological standpoint, you know, you probably know I'm a psychologist, neuropsychologist, it's interesting to think of all the major things that are studied about human beings, human psychology. There are many things that are studied, and the one that the Buddha has really zeroed in on is drive, wanting, desire, craving, greed, right? Pushing away, grabbing, clinging to. That's his focus. So I just want to highlight that as well. He's really zeroed in on wanting. Okay. So then, in his view, the wanting that creates suffering is summarized in the Pali word, Pali being the language of early Buddhism, of thirst, or tanha. It's a drive state based on an underlying sense of deficit or disturbance. Okay. That's his opinion about the pathogenic factor. It's sometimes said that the Buddha was like a great doctor, a great physician. He identified the illness, suffering. He diagnosed the cause, tanha, thirst, craving. He said it was possible to cure the patient. Woohoo! Right? And then he also said what the path was that would lead to that cure. He laid out a treatment plan. In other words, he didn't say it was hopeless, sorry, terminal, pull the plug, say goodbye, you know, it's all over. He said, no, you don't have to accept this. And that was very much his own story, as you know. He refused to accept the possibility that the complete eradication or uprooting of suffering was impossible. He refused to accept that. So, so here we are. We're zeroed in now on craving. So what is this craving? What did he mean by that? And how would it be that craving would cause suffering? So I want to get through a bit of material here, see what you think about all this, and make a practical suggestion, and call it a good night, because I've got to catch an airporter at 5 in the morning. All right. And I hope you'll excuse me for scooting out of here fairly briskly tonight. So, this is where I want to introduce two kind of fundamental chunks of Buddha Dharma, the notion of the aggregates and the chain of dependent origination. Okay, you ready? Here we go. So the Buddha said, look, we can sort everything into 5 piles. These are the aggregates, sometimes called the skandhas or the heaps. In the first pile, we have the form aggregate, right? And the form aggregate includes all of materiality and also our bare apprehension of it, our bare sensing of form out there in the world, okay? The second aggregate, it's just a way of sorting our experience. from the second aggregate on, it's all about our experience. It's all about phenomenology. Okay? So the second aggregate is called the feeling tone of experience, in Western psychology called the hedonic tone, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? Does it feel good? Does it feel bad? Does it feel meh? Okay, that's the feeling tone. The third aggregate is called perception. You can watch your stream of consciousness, and you can see these different aspects in your stream of consciousness. The third aggregate being the labeling of various things. It's a banana, it's a tree, sometimes supported by memory, maybe a little bit of an elaboration about it, but perception is still pretty basic in terms of the stream of consciousness. Then comes the fourth aggregate, which is a big pile of stuff. All our other thoughts, all our emotions. The feeling tone is not about emotion. It's more about evaluation, really. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Okay. So the fourth aggregate, sometimes called the volitional formations, or the formations in general, include, as I said, our thoughts, our emotions, our desires, our psychodynamics, our Myers-Briggs point, our Enneagram point, all the rest of that. Okay, that's the territory of volitional formations. And then the fifth aggregate is awareness itself, which is not seen as anything mystical or based on some kind of cosmic consciousness. But awareness itself is seen as something that arises dependently based on conditions. You need to have a functioning nervous system. You need to have a working sense organ that supports that aspect of awareness, like awareness of sounds, awareness of sights, awareness of thought. You need to be awake. You need to be alive for awareness to exist. Okay? Those are the five aggregates. That's like a quick survey. And it's just a way. It's a system. It's a framework, right? Like frameworks in general, it's not so much true or false, but useful or useless. All right, so you can see for yourself, is that framework useful or not? Okay, so far? Those are the aggregates. Then, here's the chain of dependent origination. All right, sounds really fancy. It is fancy. It's not so much a chain, it's more like a wheel with 16 nodes, and every node connects to every other node. So you can move through the wheel just node to node, or you can go around the whole wheel. The wheel is a common metaphor in the agrarian, rural, almost entirely pre-literate world of the Buddha. People talked about carts. The actual origin of the word dukkha, for suffering, is a combination of two sounds in Pali, du, which means basically, yucky, not good, not good. And ka, being the meeting of a wheel, the hub of a wheel and an axle. So dukkha basically means a wobbly grinding, which is a lovely, I think, way to really get at the essence, including the subtle essence of suffering, okay? It's dynamic, it's moving, and it's not ever quite right. Okay. So in this metaphor, then, of the chain of dependent origination, there are a series of links in the chain. And there's some question in scholarship about whether there are 12 nodes in the chain or links or 16, how they connect. People create various theories about it. The net of it all is I think there's a sequence in there that many, many teachers have pointed to as mapping very closely to our psychology and, as modern science is indicating, very close to our underlying neurology. And that sequence goes like this. Contact, being the meeting of a sense organ, a sense object, and a sense consciousness, you know. There is a sound, right? So there in you is the capacity to hear. You're not deaf, hopefully, right? There is also a sense object, the sound waves moving through the room produced by that bell, and there is some kind of consciousness. There is an awareness that can apprehend all of that. That's contact. In psychology, we'd call it a stimulus. Okay? Then there's feeling. So the sequence moves from contact to feeling. Feeling being the hedonic tone, the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Was that a pleasant sound? Did you enjoy it? Did you like it? Alternately, was it unpleasant, right? Did you dislike it? Or was it, Yeah, just neutral, no reaction either way. It's often the case that in experience, there's a sequence that happens very rapidly with a brain that can update the neural substrates of working memory 4 to 6 times a second fairly easily. A lot of things can happen in a second. Just watch someone playing football and tracking lots of different events, you know, over the course of a second or 2 seconds. You might have noticed that when the little banger fell off, you might have noticed, as I did, a little sense of a different contact, right? And then a little sense of alarm, a little sense of embarrassment, and then a little sense of easing, right? All in about 1.5 seconds. You can really track this going very quickly. So you can have contact feeling, contact feeling, contact feeling, and you can even have kind of a goulash of multiple stimuli happening at once that have multiple feeling tones, right? There you are eating a spicy, hot spicy food while talking to a friend. You take a bite. In the same moment that your friend is saying something really sweet and interesting, stimulus is nice, you know, the feeling tone of your friend is nice. You bite into a hot pepper and whoa, you know, contact, unpleasant, you know, feeling tone, okay? So far we have contact, stimulus, and the feeling tone. Right? Then comes craving, tanha. We tend to crave. I'll put it a little bit like this. We resist what's unpleasant, right? We go to war with it. We fight it. That's an expression of craving. That's aversion. Or alternately, we grasp after what's pleasant. We want it. We want more of it. We want it to last. We want it to be better. You know, we get driven around it, grasping, right? And then there is sort of what is neutral, and we tend to respond to that with a desire for something better, right? Kind of, let's move on to the next good thing. Okay? So we have contact, feeling, and then resisting the unpleasant, grasping after what's pleasant, and kind of wanting the neutral to get better fast, right? Or in an umbrella term, craving, which then in the sequence leads to clinging. So we go contact, feeling, craving, clinging. So now craving has congealed into kind of a more active grabbing after and pulling in and organizing around and getting self starting to really get mixed up in it, all right? That's clinging. And then after clinging, a couple more links in the chain comes suffering. So that, in a nutshell, is the sequence. And you can follow it in your own mind in about 1.5 seconds or less, right? Contact, feeling, craving, clinging, suffering. I want to make sure I got that on my recorder here. Good. It's working. All right. Okay, that's the basic idea, okay? So now I want to elaborate this very slightly and then see what you think, okay? So now, it is said that where the great great opportunity in practice is in the space between the feeling tone and the craving. We don't have any choice in the moment about contact. Stimuli happen, right? Things are happening all around us, including internal stimuli. Very important point. Thoughts arise. Suddenly out of nowhere, you start thinking about your, you know, taxes, and you go, oh my gosh, I haven't made a quarterly payment or something, or, you know, or suddenly you find yourself just kind of ruminating about something that happened a year ago, and you're reactivated around it. Stimuli arise, right? The unpleasantness of a stimulus in the moment is pretty much a given. It's that way. Over time, we can tend to condition that feeling tone, that hedonic tone that's related to a stimulus, so that increasingly things that felt unpleasant, for example, can become increasingly milder in their unpleasantness, even moving to neutral. Or we can even come to see what's actually pleasant about it. I remember my very first experience rappelling. Do you know, like you slide down a rope on a cliff? And I have a very vivid imagination. And so as I was rappelling down, and you're dangling on this rope that's stretchy, and it's only about that thick, and I could just completely imagine what would happen if the anchors pulled. you know, and I could just visualize the springy rubber bandness of the rope rippling toward me, that moment of horror, you know, ba-boom. It was very unpleasant. But with enough experience, I find rappelling just delightful because I have complete confidence in the anchors if I set them. And you know, it's fine. Okay, so, but in the moment, pretty much, contact feeling, not much to do. Where we start to have choice, where there's freedom that starts moving in, is how we respond to the feeling tone. This is a key point because the Buddha distinguished between, as he put it, chanda and tanha. Okay? Tanha is craving. Right? That's where we get into trouble, in effect, and end up with suffering in our response to, or the way we relate to, that which is unpleasant or pleasant or neutral. Okay? If we go to war with what's unpleasant, if we get driven around what's pleasant, if we kind of ignore or bat away what's neutral for the sake of something better, that's craving that creates suffering and harm for ourselves and other people. On the other hand, if there is something that is unpleasant, it is possible to relate to it in a more positive and wholesome way. If a Buddha has his hand on a hot stove, he would pull his hand away. If a Buddha saw a child walking in front of a bus, the Buddha would pull the child away from the bus, that which is unpleasant. Flip the other way, if there's the possibility of awakening or loving kindness or a moment of beauty or seeing a sunset or delighting in good company or listening to beautiful music or just enjoying a friend or the pleasure of generosity of dana, et cetera, that's pleasant. And there's a positive way to relate to that in terms of chanda, you know, this wholesome response or wholesome way of relating to that which is pleasant. Similarly, if something's neutral, there is a wholesome way to relate to it as well, where we simply be with what's neutral and are at peace with the fact that it's neutral. It doesn't need to become something good right away. See this possibility here? So moment to moment, we're continually faced with contact and feeling, stimuli and the hedonic response that's the endowment of our animal nature, which then gets conditioned somewhat through our life experiences. Things will be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, right? What will be our relationship to them? Okay, that's the fundamental question. And in Buddha Dharma, if you think about the four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishments or applications of mindfulness, different ways of translating the word that's translated as foundations, one of the four is mindfulness of the feeling tone. It's so important, it's so fundamental to become really aware in present moment time of the hedonic tone of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then very mindful of our relationship to it. In the moment, we have no choice about contact and feeling, contact and hedonic tone. Our choice, in a nutshell, is tanha or chanda, right? The path that leads to suffering and harm, or the path that leads to wholesome relationships, to embodied life, and ultimately our own awakening. That's the second noble truth. What do you think?
The
chain of dependent origination?
Yes. Is that how it's expressed in Pali?
Is that what?
How that is expressed in Pali?
The sequence I did?
Yeah. But the name of it.
Is it called the... I don't know the Pali terms for it. I don't. Maybe somebody else in the room might, but it's usually translated as chain of dependent origination. It's the idea that everything arises due to a preceding cause, which itself is quite a profound way of looking at things. Okay, yeah. So here's the takeaway in a few minutes or less, you know. Can you become increasingly mindful of the hedonic tone of your own experiences? And in your increasing mindfulness, can you help yourself increasingly shift your relationship to that which is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral from tanha to chanda, from unwholesome, unwise, unhappy craving to wholesome, wise, fruitful, eudaimonic chanda. Okay? That's really the question. Great. Grant?
Yeah. Question back when you were talking about how the neurotransmitters are constantly decaying and the synapses are dying. And I mean, can you reconcile that some with the idea of each moment coming out of the previous causes and conditions, sankharas, and how does that fit together?
Oh, if thank you. And Grant's very knowledgeable about the brain, and so it's a very important question. I think of it as like eddies in a stream. You've probably heard me use that metaphor mm-hmm. before. I think that eddies emerge, and they emerge due to preceding causes, which emerge due to preceding causes. So we have coalitions of synapses forming as a kind of physical eddy that in some way, that certainly represent a mental eddy of information that in some way, mysteriously, a fraction of which becomes subjective experience. So, and then how far back do you want to go, you know? Certainly you can go all the way back, I think, to the evolution of the nervous system, 600 million years, in terms of causes. And you can go all the way back, if Monty Python is right, you know, to the dinosaurs and, you know, the Big Bang. And you know. The Buddha said, if you really want to try to find ultimate original cause, you'll drive yourself crazy. So I'll take his word for it. All right. But the larger point, I think, what Grant is really getting at, though, you know, is, how can I put it, if we appreciate increasingly that things are streaming away, that tends to move us out of tanha to chanda. And for me, one of the useful applications of neuroscience to practice, and I think a lot of neuroscience is not relevant to practice, and a lot of practice is not usefully informed by neuroscience, but I do think one of the multiple areas where there is, I think, value is just to appreciate how mechanistic and messy and gooey and complicated and noisy this whole process of neural streaming is, you know? And when we recognize that, we realize the best we can do is just kind of lighten up about the whole thing, relax about it, try to encourage, you know, more and more wholesome causes so that this moment that's downstream from the previous upstream moment, but is upstream this moment from the next downstream moment, that we encourage wholesome causes in this moment, which will become then the upstream causes of the downstream moments we will inherit, right? That's about all we can do, I think. And that's why in the practice, by the way, I said a couple of things, just little tiny things, that if you gradually relax, you know, in meditation and, you know, train in steadiness of mind so that you become more and more able to sustain presence with, as even though content is dropping out. So you're still hearing sounds, you know, a normal condition, normal consciousness, but there's not that much thinking, there's not that much desiring or tanha, craving. It's getting fairly peaceful, and yet you're still awake, you're still present. And as that starts to happen, you start to have more and more of a sense of the kind of fizziness of consciousness. All these little bubbles of thought or sensation or recollection or, you know, inclination kind of overlapping and bubbling and passing away, and you start feeling more and more the kind of space between them. And it gets harder and harder to take them too seriously, which really takes you more into the realm of chanda. Okay.
So. In this being able to slow down the reactions in this chanda,
right, yeah.
Is chanda somewhere related to wisdom?
Okay, great. Yeah, is chanda wholesome desire related to wisdom? For sure. It's a result of wisdom, right? The wisdom to recognize the difference between wholesome and unwholesome desire, right? And the wisdom to recognize the sequence of contact, feeling, craving, and clinging. And also, wisdom comes out of chanda because we, among other things, have chanda for wisdom, you know? We You know, it's really important to appreciate that there's a place for wholesome desire. It's okay. That, in many ways, was the Buddha's radical middle way. Now, his expression of wholesome desire was to live as a profound renunciate. You know, there are those in this room who've been monks, and they know what it's like to really live by that code. It's deeply renunciate, and yet it's not an aversive way to live. It's not ascetic in a negative kind of way. It's renunciation as a beautiful fuel for freedom, right? So, with that said, the Buddha was quite prepared to engage that which is pleasant. His radical teaching was that the upper reaches of human potential are not about shutting down the feeling tones. Ultimately, is death. The upper reaches of human potential and awakening are about our relationship to embodied, lived animal experience, and to find the freedom in having a relationship to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral that's fundamentally free and wholesome in how we relate to it. Isn't that incredible? I was like, go the Buddha! Okay, one more person, then I've got to go to the airport. Or anyway, yeah, all the way in the back. Comment or question, please?
Yeah, I was interested in how this relates to treating addiction, because the clinging goes right into addiction, and the neuroscience says that neurotransmitters overload certain receptor sites, and some people say it can't be rewired, and others say it can, and I'm assuming you believe it can.
Right. Okay, so addiction is really, craving, addiction, is actually a really good model because it's an extreme form. So sometimes you can discover the truth of something by taking it to the nth degree, you know, really going all the way out. Other times you just discover what things are like when you take them to the nth degree, you know, and you can't necessarily generalize back. But here I think you can, and, you know, what you're referring to and are knowledgeable about clearly is the ways in which people progressively can habituate to a stimulus so that they need a more and more intense contact, stim, to move the reward needle at all. And also, the presence of pain is unpleasant, but the absence of expected reward is also very unpleasant, right? And that becomes a major driving force, very dopamine-driven, as I suspect you know, where there's this sense of lack, you know, deficit. Remember I said in the very beginning that craving is fundamentally in a psychological sense based on deficit and disturbance? So there's a very, very powerful sense of deficit. So I think part of the healing for addiction, which is a way to start leaning into the third noble truth, the truth of the possibility of the ending of craving, the ending of the cause of suffering. I think a lot of the paths of addiction have a top-down element where people will themselves to take a higher road. To me, that's incredibly honorable and creditable. But it's really tough to sustain white-knuckling your way through your recovery. A bottom-up way is to gradually learn to feel rewarded by more wholesome stimuli, you know, to shift from cocaine to coffee or something, and then from coffee to good company in your group, or to become to appreciate increasingly the simple pleasure in holding hands with someone rather than having to tip into some incredibly intense sexual process to move the needle, for example. And I think there, mindfulness training is really good to be able to become increasingly aware of subtleties, to appreciate pleasure. I had a teacher who said, only people of pleasure shall know the truth. You know, in a healthy sense, only people can really appreciate subtle nuances of that which is pleasurable and feel rested in that pleasure. That is an important aspect, it's not the entirety, but it's a very useful aspect, I think, of the path that ends to freedom ultimately, which goes to, how do we repeatedly internalize a felt sense of core needs met so there's no basis of deficit or disturbance? There's no basis for craving, in other words. And I think that's where the repeated internalization of wholesome experiences that are pleasant and wholesome responses to that which is unpleasant can gradually stabilize us in a deepening equanimity, like deepening the keel of a sailboat, so that when we're faced in life, as we all are, with that which is unpleasant, or that which is very pleasant and alluring, or that which is just kind of boring and bland and, you know, neutral, that instead of tipping into craving about it, because now we have a deepening, you know, sailboat, a deepening keel for our personal sailboat, we feel more and more a kind of unconditional peace, contentment, and love inside ourselves. And we don't need to get agitated around or experience a sense of deficit or disturbance around that which is unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral. And that's a beautiful process of gradually cultivating, you know, the internalization of wholesome experiences so that there's less and less basis of any kind for craving and thus suffering and harm. And that's kind of a hint for where we might go. So I invite you this coming week, as a quick recap, one, opening to suffering yourself and others. Two, surrendering to, coming to peace with the inevitability of pain, your own and others. One of the hardest things I've had to do as a parent is surrender to the inevitability of pain for my children or other loved ones. And third, from tonight, become increasingly mindful, if you can, of your relationship to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. That's the second foundation of mindfulness. It's incredibly powerful, and it gets right at installing a kind of shock absorber in the chain of dependent origination between the feeling tone and craving. So how about we sit with this for a minute and then call it a night. And it's really possible to become more and more mindful of what it feels like to not crave or to crave less and to stabilize yourself more and more in a very down-to-earth way in what it feels like to have something be unpleasant or pleasant without tipping into problematic wanting about it. And you can take in that experience too, of not craving. Thank you for your generosity of practice. That too is a form of dana. See you next week.
Thank you, Rick. That was very clear.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Clear.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That's great.
Safe travels. It was wonderful.
Thank you.